From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Tomorrow, President Trump is expected to visit El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, where the two deadly mass shootings took place over the weekend. Today, Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine is proposing modest gun control measures, urging state lawmakers to pass so-called red flag laws that would allow courts to temporarily take guns away from people determined to be dangerous. He's also calling for stronger background checks for gun purchases. Here he is at a news conference this morning.
Look, we might have some differences. We should never forget that what holds us together as Americans, as Ohioans, is so much greater than any differences.
Joining us now is Andy Chow, who's with the Ohio State House News Bureau. And Andy, this was DeWine's first press conference since the shooting. He did speak at a prayer vigil over the weekend when people interrupted him, chanting, "Do something." Today, the governor said none of his proposals is new. But do you think they're going to go anywhere in the Ohio legislature, given the environment right now?
Well, it's hard to tell. We've seen this before. Many of these proposals have been put out to the legislature in the past under former Governor John Kasich, and we sort of saw them go nowhere. But there are a couple of different things going on here that might suggest that there's more momentum for these proposals. One is Governor Mike DeWine is better liked among Republican legislators. He has more goodwill among the Republican-controlled Senate and House. And Governor Mike DeWine also spoke to several pro-gun groups before he laid out these measures. And so there were some gun rights advocates there to speak after the press conference who seem to be not necessarily in support of these, but they're not actively fighting them right now. So if the meter is going to change a little bit, if the ball is going to move a little bit, it might be under these circumstances. And unfortunately, it might have been this tragedy that gets us there.
Let's talk about the proposals. First of all, how would the red flag law work if that were passed?
So a lot of the gun groups said that the red flag law has been something that they've been actively fighting against in Ohio since last year. But under the way Governor Mike DeWine is sort of crafting his own proposal here, sort of customizing a little bit, they're saying that they might be okay with it because the big issue here is due process to them. DeWine says that this would be issued by the court. So the court would decide within 3 days if firearms should be taken away from someone because that person does pose a risk to themselves or to others. And then there'd be other court cases along the way to sort of monitor that situation and then provide some sort of mental health care for that person to get sort of a psychiatric evaluation.
And what about the issue of background checks? How significant is what he's proposing there?
That's a pretty significant thing here in Ohio. And in fact, there was a poll conducted in Ohio just days before the Dayton shooting that said 90% of Ohioans want universal background checks. Now, usually we don't pay a whole lot of attention to polls, but when a poll comes out with 90%, you have a kind of a clear idea that this is something that the people of Ohio want. Plus, there's already a ballot group who've been trying to petition for signatures to get it on the ballot. So there's also pressure from a citizens group and trying to get legislators to pass universal background checks as well. That's been a big sticking point for pro-gun groups, however, because they say that's another step towards limiting their access to guns.
And would this be universal, what he's proposing?
It would. This would require background checks for all gun purchases, for all gun sales, really requiring you to go through a federally licensed dealer, and those federally licensed dealers must conduct background checks. So what we're talking about here, a lot of the sticking points have been online purchases, which you don't have to necessarily go through a background check, and gun shows, which is usually known as the gun show loophole.
One more thing. President Trump is going to be coming to Dayton tomorrow. There's some protest about his visit to El Paso tomorrow. But this is what Governor DeWine said when he was asked about going to Dayton with the president.
When I go, I say, look, I represent the people of Ohio. People are grieving all over Ohio for you. When the president comes, he can say that about the country. And in both cases, it happens to be true.
Are there people who don't want the president to visit Dayton?
I think it's fair to say that there are going to be a lot of people who do not want the president to come visit Dayton. But it's important to remember that he does have a lot of support here in Ohio. When it comes to favorability polls, he hasn't really lost a lot of support among Ohio voters. So there's also going to be a large amount of people who want to see him come to Dayton and who want to see him visit with families.
Andy Chow with the Ohio Statehouse News Bureau in Columbus. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, as we noted yesterday, we're ratcheting up our climate change coverage, a reboot, if you will. And as if on cue, climate change is ratcheting up as well. This past July was not just the hottest July, but the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. This is from data from the Copernicus Climate Change Service, a European climate agency. And it's one reason news organizations like The Guardian are switching from climate change to climate emergency. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State. He joins us from New York's Long Island, where he's been speaking. And Professor, you tell us people in that beach area are asking how much longer they'll be able to be there because of rising seas. This is disturbing information.
It is. And of course, July is the warmest month of the year globally. It's summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and the Northern Hemisphere has more land, so it heats up and cools down more with the seasons. So when it's hottest here, it's hottest for the globe. Yeah. And that means that the hottest July is the hottest month. We just saw the hottest month on record. Wow. For the globe. And it's no longer simply a theoretical concept. When we talk about the global average temperature, it seems very abstract. But now we can see the context for that. The context is record heat waves here in the U.S., in Europe, and around the world.
Well, when you talk about the temperatures, let's remind people, the Paris Climate Agreement, which the U.S. Was a part of, has been pulled out of, but world leaders committed to preventing the planet from warming more than 3.6 degrees, that's 2 Celsius, and they're trying to keep global warming even more limited to 2.4 degrees, not 3.6, that's 1.5 Celsius. But this data showed that last month was 1.01 degrees Celsius. I just said they're trying to keep it to 1.5. Have I read that right?
You have, and it's important to recognize that that 1.1 degrees Celsius, that's relative to a baseline that is fairly recent, 1981 to 2010. The globe had already warmed up about a degree by that time. Mm-hmm. And so really, if we were to take a pre-industrial baseline before the planet was warmed up by our burning of fossil fuels and the greenhouse gases that is creating, it's closer to 2 degrees Celsius warming. Here's the good news. You know, individual months fluctuate a lot over time. And so sometimes that leads to an upward spike and sometimes that leads to a downward spike. But as we warm the planet, we will see extreme spikes that are larger and larger. And that's the context for understanding these heat waves that we've seen as well.
Sizzling heat in Paris and heat waves in Europe, that has contributed to this global temperature rise that we're talking about. But has the global temperature rise also produced more extreme heat events?
Absolutely. What the overall warming of the planet is doing, it's literally shifting the bell curve. The average is in the center, and then you have these sort of tails on either side. As you go farther and farther away from the average, the probability gets lower and lower. But when you shift that bell curve towards higher temperatures, then that extreme tail gets shifted as well. And so even a warming of the planet of about 1 degree Celsius can actually lead to a tenfold increase in the occurrence, say, of 100-degree days in a place like New York City. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way to understand these unprecedented heat waves.
Well, and the other good news, and I'm making air quotes here, is that we know that this climate change, climate emergency, as many are now calling it, is caused by human emissions that are warming the planet. But given the heat records that we're hearing, how much time is there to reverse that, those emissions?
You know, the fact is that the carbon that we've already burned and put into the atmosphere, that'll be in the atmosphere for decades to come. That's the legacy simply of the fossil fuels we've already burned. And so what we need to do is prevent those levels of carbon dioxide from crossing 450 parts per million. That's the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. Prior to industrialization, it was about 280 parts per million. We've increased that number from 280 now to about 412. And we will hit 450 in less than a decade or so if we continue to burn fossil fuels at historic rates. And so in order to prevent the CO2 levels from reaching 450 parts per million, which probably commits us to 2 degrees Celsius warming, we've got to bring those emissions down very rapidly so that we've cut them in half by 2030 and eliminate carbon emissions by 2050. That will keep warming, in fact, below a degree and a half Celsius, that number that increasingly we point to as where some of the worst impacts of climate change really do start to become evident.
That's Professor Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric sciences at Penn State University, talking about something we're not really celebrating, July, the hottest month ever in recorded history. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
The Trump administration is hoping to reduce the number of asylum seekers at the U.S. border by requesting that they seek asylum in a third country like Guatemala first. But our next guest says that until conditions improve in the countries the migrants are fleeing, no new rules will work. Specifically, she's talking about Hondurans who trek through Guatemala, then Mexico, to the U.S. border. In her chilling New York Times op-ed, Pay or Die, journalist Sonia Nazario continues her pretty disturbing look at life in Honduras and the corruption that exists at every level of life there, literally embedding herself, crouching on the floor in the back of a cab as the driver heads out to pay his extortion fee to a murderous gang. Nazario wrote the book Enrique's Journey, is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She joins us from Los Angeles. Sonia, welcome back.
So happy to be back.
Well, last time we talked, it was specifically about the horrific violence against women in Honduras. And I'm going to give the same warning today that I did then. Some of this violence is stomach-turning. You talked then about women being skinned alive by gangs. In your new piece, you describe a young girl who's murdered slowly by a gang who cut her arm off piece by piece because they thought she was snitching. To people who say, oh, it can't be that bad, you say what?
The neighborhood I spent time in reporting this piece would not even say the name of the gangs. They would talk about antisocial elements. It felt like Voldemort, he who shall not be named. Mm-hmm. And at the top of the hill, the 18th Street gang, they wanted a girl to be the gang leader's girlfriend, and she had refused. And so they dragged her through the streets 20 blocks by her hair, and people were so afraid. She was calling out to people for a Bible because she knew what was going to happen to her, and no one came out of their houses to help her because they're so terrified.
Well, and as you write, these gangs are allowed to act with impunity because of this corruption that you describe from the top. The U.S. was quick to support the new president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, after his very questionable election. His brother is associated with a drug cartel. He would put his initials on the packages of drugs. His sister was implicated in an embezzlement case. I mean, talk about the rot at the head.
Well, the president has acknowledged some wrongdoing. He was elected in 2014, and the campaign funds that he spent for that in part came from a massive scam where $300 million were siphoned off from the national insurance system. So he's acknowledged some wrongdoing. But, you know, there are two ways to steal illegally in Honduras, in places like Honduras. You either take money from the drug cartels to look the other way or help them move drugs through that country on the way to the United States. Or you pilfer from the public coffers. Mm-hmm. And the allegation is that by establishing these nonprofits that do business with the government, that are linked to the president's family, that tens of millions of dollars maybe going that route. There was a nonprofit entity called Frijoles Ay. There are beans, but no beans were distributed. There was a nonprofit that was supposed to distribute uniforms to school children, $9 million. No school uniforms allegedly were distributed. Mm-hmm. These are the concerns that the rot starts at the very top and that the U.S. is supporting someone who is engaged allegedly in corruption.
You talk about school children not having uniforms. They don't have teachers because many of the teachers are fake.
They're so-called ghost teachers. So what was seen about a decade ago was that a lot of teachers that were supposed to be in classrooms were not in classrooms. And the problems were that only 88 days out of 200, the teachers were actually teaching, and one in four that were supposed to be in the classroom weren't showing up at all. And so this nonprofit called the Association for a More Just Society, they're the arm of Transparency International in Honduras, did a survey of schools, and they found that there were supposed to be 85,000 teachers, but in reality, there were only 55,000. Mm. The rest were ghost teachers. So they had been given a job as a political favor, or had paid to get the job, paid a bribe, or had slept with the right person to get a job. There was a whole soccer team in the town of Danlí in Honduras, 22 players that were being paid as teachers.
So it's not just schools. The healthcare system, people are dying. Talk about the money that's being funneled there.
So the allegations are that corrupt politicians, heads of hospitals and ministries are basically getting contracts where the money is being skimmed off the top for medications or for ambulances, or the medications aren't arriving at all. Yeah. And so you saw medications for hypertension, for diabetes, that simply didn't work, that were no better than a placebo. And so the estimates are that at least 2,000 people in a four-year period died because of these bad medicines.
Yeah. And then there's the police. Who would call the police? In 2016, 5,000 officers fired for corruption, all 40 of the highest ranking officers dismissed for being criminals. And 100 police officers and officials are actually members of one of the most murderous gangs, MS-13, which started in Los Angeles, now entrenched in Honduras. Talk about the effect on one town as this all filters down. You were talking about the town where they wouldn't even say the name.
So I spent a lot of time in a neighborhood called Nueva Suyapa in the capital of Honduras. And you see this corruption play out. There's a woman who said that she got bad insulin and her mother almost died, almost went blind because of this. There's a social worker who talked about how he watched police officers take a payment from the MS-13 gang. And because of the extortion that people live with, the war tax, that anything that is on wheels, taxis, buses, motorcycle taxis, must pay every Monday morning to the gangs, but also the businesses in this neighborhood. These little mom-and-pop stores, they have to pay half of what they make every single day. And one in four businesses in this neighborhood had shut down altogether. And if you don't pay, they kill you. In one decade, more than 1,500 transportation owners or drivers have been murdered.
You saw this firsthand. You lay down in the back seat of a car to go with a bus driver on his weekly trip to pay his gang tax. I would imagine the hair was up on your arm the whole time you're there.
You know, there are thousands of bus owners and drivers every Monday morning making these payments to the gang. Some of them are paying three gangs every week. Some of them are paying six gangs every week. And so I wanted to see how this worked. So I went with a bus owner. He hops in his car. I get in the wheel well of the back seat and try to crouch down there and not be seen. And we go and we pick up this block of cash from the bus dispatcher. And then we head up this hill into this neighborhood called Las Pavas, which is an 18th Street stronghold. And as we're going up, there are all these lookouts with AK-47s watching our progress up the hill with the gang. And as we reach the top, we stopped. These two youths appeared out of nowhere. He lowered the window 2 inches, shoved the block of cash through the window, and they disappeared. And that cash will go through 10 hands before it reaches the gang leader. But in all, these transportation owners are paying, just in the capital, $23 million a year in war taxes, estimated.
But, you know, everything you're saying might be heard by someone as proof that the U.S. should not support Honduras, because It's so corrupt. Where will the money go? You point out that the U.S. Did not protest when Guatemala kicked out the U.N.-sponsored anti-corruption team there, which has allowed this to get worse. Can anything be done? Is it so entrenched? You know, people are starting to say, invest in what? I mean, how do you do it?
You know, you either make it so nasty when people get here that you think that that will stop this flow, or you deal with what's pushing them out. And if you want to slow migration, the conclusion I came to is that you have to address this swamp in Honduras. And there are things that we're working to reduce violence and reduce impunity and build up better governance. I've seen these programs work in neighborhoods that I've been to previously, and it reduces violence in these neighborhoods, and it reduces the number of people that are fleeing these neighborhoods. The money doesn't go to the government that we give in foreign aid. It goes to vetted international aid groups, nonprofits in Honduras, and we need to set clear benchmarks for whether this is working or not. And if they don't meet those benchmarks, the government then cut off aid. And I argued strongly, it's cheaper, it's more humane, it's more effective to try to change those things in a place like Honduras than to spend billions of dollars locking people up in these horrible prisons in the United States.
And by the way, the people you met, they want to stay in Honduras. You also say the U.S. has to own its role in this. In 1975, a U.S. company paid something like $250,000 as a bribe to the president of Honduras in exchange for lowering taxes on banana exports. In the 1980s, the U.S. paid Honduras, you know, millions.
And we didn't care how the politicians spent the money. They could pocket it as long as it bought their allegiance to have the Contras operating in Honduras against the Nicaraguan Sandinistas.
And, of course, the U.S. is the biggest purchaser of the drugs that are part of the industry in Honduras.
And we didn't demand new elections in 2017 when the current president was reelected in very dubious circumstances. The Organization of American States, they don't do this often, called for new elections, and the United States looked the other way and said, we're okay with this. And that cemented that president continuing on. So we're not innocent in all this, but we have, through our foreign aid, tried to start through the humanitarian aid, not military and police aid, have tried to start to change some of these things and bring out the corruption and address it and put politicians in jail. And that's what will change things in Honduras, mm-hmm. and will lower, ultimately, the number of people fleeing to our southern border.
You are aware that President Hernandez was very unhappy with your article.
He seemed to be, yes.
Are you going back soon to Honduras?
Probably not. Yeah. You know, it's not good to piss off people in high places.
We'll link you to her piece on Honduras in the New York Times at herenow.org. Sonia, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
After the two mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, some groups like Guns Down America are calling on Walmart in particular to stop selling guns after 22 people were killed at that hugely popular store in El Paso. Walmart is one of the largest sellers of guns and ammunition in the world. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, we know that Walmart stopped selling assault-style rifles in 2015.
Yeah.
And then after the shooting in 2018 in Parkland, Florida, they raised the age of purchase of guns to 21. Some Republican legislators are calling for that now. So what is Walmart selling?
Well, Walmart doesn't sell so-called assault rifles, right? It's not a technical term, but it's really a gun, a long gun that is typically not used for hunting. It's automatic or semi-automatic. It is not like a rifle or a shotgun. Now, Walmart does still sell rifles and things for hunting. It also still sells guns for what you would call self-defense, guns that you can carry on you. So it's just this particular category of gun, which tend to be used in most of these mass shootings, that Walmart is not selling, and also not selling to people under the age of 21.
Well, and how is it doing? Because some are pointing out that gun sales aren't a high-margin business for Walmart.
It's not.
They're down.
Right. So the problem is, if you were never in the gun-selling business, this wouldn't be an issue, right? If you were a sporting goods store that wasn't Dick's and didn't already sell guns, and then Dick's decided not to, this wouldn't be an issue. The problem is, Walmart sells them. So now it's a political position after 2015 to have said that it wasn't going to do it. And that has upset some people with Walmart. But fundamentally, if you were to make a decision about what to keep in your store because you want to make more money, guns aren't selling as fast and guns are not as good a margin as toys and pet things, for instance.
Yeah, but it, so now it becomes maybe not just a business decision, but an impression that
Correct.
They leave when they do this. And studies show Republicans typically like Walmart better than Democrats do. But Democrats' impression of Walmart has been inching up in the past few years. People study this kind of thing.
Yes.
So if you're Walmart CEO Doug McMillon and you're looking at the horizon, you've, as I just said, you have some Republican lawmakers for the first time calling for things like expanded background checks, raising the age of gun sales. You have the NRA in a kind of a an organizational mess right now.
Yes.
Maybe you seize that moment.
This could be an opportunity. Yeah. Look, Walmart is not a company that likes to take on something called corporate policy virtue signaling. It's just they are really big. Walmart sees more Americans than any government agency does, than anybody else does in a week. That is, you know, they try to be as apolitical as possible. The reason it's more favored amongst Republicans is largely where these Walmarts are, right? They tend to be in rural areas, not in city areas. Increasingly, they're showing up in cities, which is why more urban buyers are seeing Walmart. But fundamentally, Walmart is never going to be at the front of something if they can avoid being at the front of something that feels political. But you're right. Insofar as rather than saying we're going to ban all gun sales, they're going to start to reduce the floor space that's dedicated to them. That might be an opportunity that Walmart has right now.
Yeah. Ali Velshi of MSNBC anchor and correspondent. And, you know, Walmart also has to be reeling. What a horror to have this happen.
To have that happen in your store. That's exactly right. And that is the opportunity it's got to take to say this is more serious than just a policy.
Yeah. And to remind people, this particular Walmart in El Paso saw 65,000 people a week.
Yeah.
Ali, thank you so much.
My pleasure, friend.
The environmental impact of bottled water is significant. Most bottled water comes in plastic, a petroleum product, and even though most bottles are recyclable, the vast majority of them are not recycled. Yet the demand for bottled water is strong. It is the top-selling beverage by volume. Americans buy, get this, more than 40 billion bottles of water every year. Which brings us to a product called Just Water, founded by Jaden Smith and his father, the actor Will Smith. It's trying to make bottled water more eco-friendly. Joining us now as part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top is Ira Laufer, CEO of Just Goods, which makes Just Water. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So one of the things that makes Just Water different from other bottled waters is the packaging. It's in a carton rather than a plastic bottle. Now, the carton still does contain some plastic as well as paper and aluminum. But why is this packaging more sustainable, do you think, than plastic bottles?
It's a step in the right direction. So if you look at our packaging and what we do as a company and how we source our water and the ethically sourced model, overall, it fits our mission and intentions of trying to create good for this world and give people products that make them feel good about themselves but also contribute to a better and cleaner world. And we do that through this specific product.
Well, and so tell me about the packaging specifically. What's so great about it?
So the packaging is primarily made out of paper. It's 82% renewable resources. It does have, as you called out, a liner of aluminum and some plastic in it. In addition to the paper content, we have a unique cap and shoulder that are plant-based plastic. So from a renewable content perspective, it's a pretty interesting type of format because we look at the entire life cycle of the product and what it takes to create a package. In addition to that, it is recyclable in municipalities that do recycle paper products. So if you look at the entire life cycle of the product from start to finish, it's a much better product for the environment.
And is it widely recyclable? I mean, because it has a combination of materials, does it make it more difficult for people to recycle them?
It is. You know, recycling is a challenge globally. recycling infrastructure are growing, and it's about, you know, creating more awareness and education to consuming more products that come from paper and alternatives to the traditional plastic and other formats. And then with usage and demand, there are more opportunity for increased infrastructure for recycling.
Now, does it hold the water as well as a plastic bottle or as a, you know, metal reusable bottle that a lot of people have these days, or a glass bottle? Does it hold the water as well? Because one of the complaints that people have about the new straws that are paper mm-hmm. straws that are more sustainable, obviously, than plastic straws, or they don't end up in the ocean, is that they don't hold the water as well. They don't hold the liquid as well.
Correct. And that's where the aluminum liner that we have in the product comes to play. Every beverage product has some sort of a liner in it, whether it's something that is visible or it's in a layer within that specific package. That is in order to ensure the integrity of the product, you know, from a drinking experience to holding the water to food safety.
Another thing that is different about your water product is that the water source, you say right on the side of the package that it comes from just the tap in Glens Falls, New York.
So we are very proud of our water source model, or the ethically sourced model, which was very important for us when we started this company. It's not about being a sustainable package. It's about how we look at it from a holistic approach and what is it that we put in our product and what impact it has both on the environment and on the communities in which we partner with. And we found an amazing water source upstate New York in a city that is 3 hours north of New York City. And it's called Glens Falls, and they have amazing, ample amount of spring water. And we went into one-of-a-kind relationship between a municipality and a privately held company in which we actually have a model where we buy their excess water and we pay them six times the municipal rate. So that's where the ethical sourcing and environmental impact and social impact comes to play.
Why do you pay them six times the municipal rate?
That was the agreement back then. Why is it six and not seven? I'm not quite sure.
But why don't you just pay them the normal rate?
Because we wanted to make sure that there is a tangible impact through this partnership. So if you ever get to visit Glens Falls, New York, and you go to downtown, you can actually see different tangible things that have been addressed by the proceeds from this agreement. So it allows them to create additional infrastructure and improve their water infrastructure.
Is there any other way that Just Water is different than any other water?
Just is very different from any other water and every other company that is out there. It's interesting to mention that Just is not a water company and nor is it a packaging company, right? So Just is really a movement, and I think that's what really sets us apart. Because Just was created on the basis of doing good and doing things differently and demonstrate how businesses can be part of a solution by giving people products that make them feel good about themselves and also contribute to a better world. So we're doing it with environmental impact and community impact and ethical sourcing and innovation. And we do it in a very transparent and authentic way, and we are very inclusive in the way we do things. And I think that is something that is quite unique for a beverage company, but obviously, generally speaking, for a company that is really trying to create a bigger impact on every step of the way that we make a product.
Now, you're the CEO, but the company was founded by Jaden Smith and his father, Will Smith, celebrities themselves. Do they get involved in the day-to-day running of the company?
Not in the day-to-day, but they are certainly involved, more so Jaden, because he's the catalyst behind this brand, right? The whole thing started with him swimming in the ocean when he was 11 years old and seeing a bunch of plastic trash floating in the ocean and really got home tilted and wanted to do something about it. So that's what really drove the decision to start a company and name it Just, because Just stands for justice. And Jaden is certainly a board member and is quite active and opinionated. And Will is involved on different level, but the entire Smith family is quite passionate about this company. And it's interesting to see it because, as I mentioned, it's come from a very authentic place.
Now, there are some listeners who are going to hear what you're talking about and say, great, it's good that they're doing this, but wouldn't it be better if everybody just used reusable bottles for their water rather than having packaging that has to be recycled even?
100% agree. And our bottle actually is meant to be refillable. It has a wide cap. All we're saying is that if you have access to clean water, please drink tap water. If you don't have access or you happen to be in a place that gives out a single serve bottle of water, just is better for everyone. And as I said, we acknowledge the fact that we're not the perfect solution, but the alternative is doing nothing. So we are certainly a step in the right direction.
Do you think that some of your competitors in the plastic bottle industry are doing nothing?
I think everyone is doing something. I think currently there are no clear solutions to the problem, and every solution has its own challenges. So, you know, you see the big companies and small companies trying to take different initiatives towards sourcing and how to improve their current package. So the more companies that come to market with sustainable package, that is a better step in the right direction until we come to a perfect solution, are welcome.
I want to ask you one more thing. You brought up the issue of recycling and the fact that China used to import a lot of our recycling materials, but it stopped doing that last year. That's led to global problems, and less stuff is being recycled, more ending up in landfills, and some ending up in the ocean. Have you thought, as the CEO of this company, about what the solution is to that problem?
To be honest, solution does not exist at the moment. I think the bigger issue here, and this is why we welcome more companies to come into this category, is about creating education and awareness. Because recycling is fantastic as long as consumers take their products and actually place them in the recycling bin. And that's where you can make the biggest impact, because most people, unfortunately, do not recycle. There was a recent article saying how 96% of Americans are completely confused about recycling. Where does it need to be? Does it get recycled really? Where should I place it? So I think there's a lot of education that is needed around that environmental impact and issues around recycling, and that's where it should start in order to try to mitigate some of these issues.
That's Ira Laufer, who is the CEO of Just Goods, which makes Just Water. Ira, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Let's turn to Brazil now and yet another look at the effects of climate change. In recent decades, the climate of the Amazon has become more extreme. Rainfall has become more intense, even as it's suffered repeated droughts, which were previously rare. Scientists want to know more about the world's largest rainforest, home to more species of plants and animals than anywhere else on Earth. Most of their research takes place on the ground, but sometimes they get lost in the clouds. Daniel Grossman has this reporter's notebook.
Okay, let's see, I got my harness on. Okay, I'm at the base of the tower. I'm just going to go right up.
It's dawn in the heart of the Amazon, rising straight up into the jungle canopy and disappearing into the darkness in front of me are the struts of a giant structure called the Amazon Tall Tower Observatory, or ATO. I'm strapped into a bulky harness. If I stumble on Otto's slick steps, a safety system I'm clipped to will keep me from slipping through the latticework and falling to the ground. At least that's the idea.
So this tower is the tallest human-made structure in all of South America. It's 321 meters tall, a little over 1,000 feet, taller than the Eiffel Tower, 7 steps from one landing to the next, and then the staircase turns. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Biologist Carlos Casado, one of the scientists overseeing ATO, says a key question is whether global warming will cut back rainfall here and dry out the forest. Finding the answer requires understanding how the jungle's trees help to create clouds.
And the whole idea of the project is try to understand how gases emitted by the forest, from the soil, from the plants, how they connect with the atmospheric chemistry to create clouds, to produce rain.
To study the cloud-making machinery, researchers need samples of air with the chemical signature of the entire forest. They can't get those near the ground, where the canopy keeps distant drafts from wafting in. But there's a stiff breeze up here near the top of the tower, and it carries a blend of gases and particles that it picked up crossing the continent.
Because of the height, it is able to sample a very huge area of the Amazon.
Now I can see it's like tops of the trees, kind of like a crate of broccoli. Each tree is like a florette. Getting kind of windy.
Before the tower was completed in 2015, the only way to sample such air was to use airplanes and balloons, grabbing only an occasional whiff.
My name is Andrew Crozier. I'm an electronics engineer, and I kind of do a little bit of everything.
I can basically just start showing you the laboratories if you'd like.
The tower has thermometers and other standard gear, as well as exotic instruments, such as a device that measures sunlight. But Otto's primary role is a seemingly mundane task, holding up inlets and carrying air samples in tubing to the ground. This lab at the base is devoted to microscopic droplets emitted from living trees and fine particles from forest fires.
So we generally have the inlets from the tower coming down through stainless steel tubing.
Keeping all this equipment running isn't easy. Jungle heat and humidity are tough on electronics. Insects are a constant headache. Spiders sometimes block the laser beam of Crozier's fog detector.
And they climb in there and build a nest and lay their little egg sac inside there, and then I have no signal from the instrument.
Crozier has to climb up to the top to clean out the nest.
That could take easily, 45 minutes or an hour to get up there, and then another 30 minutes to come down.
Recently, technicians installed Otto's first passenger elevator. It takes only 13 minutes each way, saving Crozier a lot of effort and making an evacuation faster if a researcher suffers a medical emergency.
Oh, my muscles are kind of screaming now. Whoa. Here it is, 321 meters above the ground. It's a good climb, although I think maybe next time I'll take the elevator.
For Here and Now, at the Amazon Tall Tower Observatory, I'm Daniel Grossman.